Hello, I'm François Joly. This is number 0213, the Stuff File program, with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of The Stuff File program, number 0213. And coming up on this edition of The Stuff File program, actor Eric Pierpoint is the author of a young reader's novel called The Last Ride of Caleb O'Toole. What made him write historical fiction for a younger crowd?
I wanted to write an historical fiction story, a Western, a lot of it based on my own family background. But one of the things that happened some years ago when I was in Montana, I was on a horseback ride with a little guy. He was 12 years old at that time. He was my little brother in the Big Brother Association. And I decided it would be far more interesting to write it from the point of view of a boy instead of a grown man, because he has so much to learn.
Edward Meyer from Ripley's Believe It or Not talks about their latest book, Dare to Look, which is a visually stunning tome chalked filled with great stories and pictures.
I don't think we'll ever run out of Believe It or Not stories, but I often wonder how we keep coming up with such great pictures, because there's about 500 per book, and in general, I think most people, you know, that's what they remember, is the visual image as opposed to, you know, the caption underneath or the sidebar stories that don't have pictures.
Tech specialist Mike Salvaggio, co-founder of SEO Brand, weighs in on the Mac versus PC debate.
The majority of people that are using computers are just novices, right? They just want to browse the internet, they want to check their email, they want to play around on social media. And Macs make it very easy to do these basic functions, as to where Windows sometimes gets confused in terms of, I need to be a hardcore coder or a programmer to really have all these different capabilities, where the majority of people just want to check their email and browse the web.
And there's lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0213, was François Joly, who is a freelance cameraman, and he also works at that other place I work, Global News Montreal. Thank you very much, François, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we, on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, under the banner that can only be deemed as sad and pathetic, self-indulgent New York City parents have been hiring playdate coaches for their preschool youngsters, apparently out of fear that the kids' skill set for just having fun might not impress admissions officers at the city's elite private schools. The CEO of one consulting outfit told the New York Post in July that $400 an hour gets expert monitoring of a four-year-old in small groups, evaluating, for example, how the child colors in a book, shares the crayons, holds a pencil, and follows the rules of Simon Says. Wow. Do you get a refund if your kid just eats paste? I mean, if this isn't a prime example of first world problems, I don't know what is. But, you know, there is someone out there who was savvy enough to create this alleged need, thereby sucking money out of overly concerned parents who clearly have more dollars than cents. And as I said in the story, the quote came from the CEO of one consulting outfit that does this, which means there's more than one. That's frightening. Anyway, moving right along, researchers at the University of Tokyo have developed a mirror that makes a person appear happy even when they're not. A built-in camera tracks facial features in real time, then tweaks the image to turn up the corners of the mouth and to create the beginnings of a smile in the eyes. Of what practical use would such a mirror be? Well, other Japanese researchers believe that happy face mirrors in retail stores would improve shoppers' dispositions and lead to more sales. I don't know where to begin in assessing how horribly wrong this idea seems to be, but may I remind you that while there are those who have developed a mirror that would appear to make you smile, we still have not found the cure for cancer. I'm just saying. Well, a home ownership boom in China has led to heavily attended housing fairs in which builders compete zealously to sell their homes, leading to offbeat schemes to draw attention. Now, among the latest is one that dresses female models in bare-backed evening wear with sample floor plans and other housing information painted onto their skin, and then sends them wandering through the crowds. Wow, nobody in the West thought of this one before? This is why China's winning. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Florida's Attorney General has joined AGs from two other states to demand that a clothing company stop selling a line of T-shirts. It's not the price, which is, by the way, $58, or $98 if you want one of them with long sleeves, but because of the message that's on them. Rather than a person's name on the back of the sports jersey-style shirts, they're emblazoned with the names of several popular prescription drugs, Vicodin, Xanax, or Adderall. Now, the AG's letter to California-based Kitson, and released to the press, by the way, says that, quote, prescription drug abuse is not fun or humorous, and asked the company to withdraw the shirts. The company has responded that it will as soon as the TV network stops showing advertising and taking advertising money from the drug companies. The AGs say the shirts have no redeeming social value in that they, quote, do not open the door to a dialogue, unquote, as the designer claims. Oh, really? Well, everybody seems to be talking about them right now. Sounds like an open dialogue to me. Yep. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, shall we? Eric Pierpoint is a veteran Hollywood actor, but he has now taken his talent in another direction by writing a novel for young readers entitled The Last Ride of Caleb O'Toole. Eric joins us on the line right now from California to talk a little about his career and also his new book. Hi, Eric.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks for being on the program with us.
No problem. I love it.
Writing a book for young readers, why particularly that age group, first of all?
Well, you know, when I first thought about this story, it was mainly I wanted to write a historical fiction story, a Western, a lot of it based on my own family background. But one of the things that happened some years ago when I was in Montana, I was on a horseback ride with a little guy. He was 12 years old at that time. He was my little brother in the Big Brother Association. You're familiar with that?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, we were outside of Yellowstone, and for pretty much the entire day, we wandered around on two horses, and no guide, with just a map. And it was one of the best times I've ever had, and I would once in a while look back, and I would see him struggling with his horse, and wondered, well, what would it be like? I kept putting myself back in time as I'm thinking about this story that I'm writing. And I decided it would be far more interesting to write it from the point of view of a boy instead of a grown man, because he has so much to learn. And how can he learn, and what will he learn? What are the tools that he'll need to get to survive in the 1870s West? So that's kind of how that started.
Now, I've mentioned that you're an actor. People might know you from things like certainly Alien Nation. You've been on Parks and Rec. But in doing a book like this, in writing just generally, is it like using a different creative muscle for you?
Yeah, it's very different. The investigation that you do as an actor, you know, you're investigating, you're researching for your character. You're kind of digging in, trying to find the layers. It's you expand that when you're writing a novel, especially historical fiction. So I found myself as sort of like a private investigator. And plus, the satisfaction you get as an actor is mostly immediate. At least it is on stage. You know, you get instant feedback from your performance on stage and the reaction of the audience and how the whole thing flowed. You see your rewards somewhat later on in terms of when you're doing film and television. And film and television is cut. So while you can have a lot of satisfaction doing certain things, you're always kind of stopping. And in a way, a novel is a bit like that. You're in a flow, then you stop, and then you struggle, and then you're in another flow. So, but I did find that my literary agent gave me one of the best notes. She said, use your experience as an actor to influence your writing. And that I got immediately, because it just told me that you have a sort of an internal mechanism of when to move off and keep things moving and keep it interesting. So I think that's probably the best note I ever got.
Now, in addition to that, you're also the son of Robert Pierpoint, who was a CBS correspondent for many, many years. Certainly one of Murrow's boys back in the day. And when it comes to practicing journalism, certainly back then, it was all about the writing. So
yeah.
is that part of your dad's legacy, just doing a book like this?
Yeah, you know, I think about that quite a bit, because I didn't really know that whether or not I could pull this off, you know, to write a story that was compelling, because it's so much work, you know. And my dad was, you know, he was a real, real straight, very, very competent professional broadcaster, correspondent for during six presidencies. So he covered the White House. I knew how much effort he put into fact-finding and checking his facts. So I keep hearing his voice, you know. I keep feeling like I got a lot of that from him. So when I go, I find it very interesting to kind of keep pulling the snakes out of the holes. And then from all of that, to start spinning the story. Sometimes the facts influence the characters, and sometimes the characters are flying off by themselves. But I really do think that he had a lot of, when he was living, a lot of influence, and even when he's passed, he still does.
Well, the book, The Last Ride of Caleb O'Toole, is a book of fiction, and it's a book that goes back in time. But you mentioned doing research and fact-finding. You actually traveled, if I'm not mistaken, along the Oregon Trail to do this book?
Yeah. You know, I was sitting there with my computer, and I was spitting all of these stories out of my head, and I kind of felt like I was lacking something. So I decided to pack up, put my dog in the car, and head out to Kansas, start from the town of Great Bend, where the story begins. And then I really wanted to get a sense of the landscape. And just sort of feel what it must have been like, you know, pull off on the side of the road, do a little riding by a stream or a lake or a plain or a mountain, or go to museums, talk to historians. So I spent a month on the trail going from town to town and sort of landmark to landmark that took me through up to Nebraska along the Platte River, up through Wyoming, Yellowstone, and through the gold mining towns of Montana, and ended up in the Bitterroot Mountains, and I had a blast.
So tell us what the story is about in The Last Ride of Caleb O'Toole.
It's about, the central character is a 12-year-old boy. He has two sisters. They are left orphaned. There was a cholera epidemic in Great Bend. They're also witnesses to a murder. The dying wishes of the mother are that Caleb take his two sisters up to try to get on the railroad that'll take them west toward Montana and then up into the Bitterroot area to live with their aunt. Well, everything goes wrong. First of all, there was a railroad strike in 1877. Plus, the railroad wasn't even finished to go up that north in far north in Montana. And the kids are being pursued by this gang of bad guys. And they are befriended and actually rescued by a gunfighter. And the gunfighter shot up, and they in turn rescue him. So various friends that they meet along the way provide support for the kids. Some Native American characters come into the picture. Some are actual historical figures, like Chief Touch the Clouds, Sitting Bull. There's, you know, an assortment of characters that from actual history. And so I get to touch on a lot of themes. I get to touch on some of the Indian Wars. I get to touch on the Western migration, what it was like to be in a wagon train. And it all ends up at a big battle in the Bitterroot Mountains.
Would anybody who's known you most of your life, would they see any of Caleb in you? In other words, is this you at 12?
Partially. Caleb meets a lot of men who are very capable figures who kind of help him along the way. And I had some in my life when I was a young boy. I identify with Caleb in that way. Also, every kid wants to be a hero. And I also identify with a gunfighter. The gunfighter is a, you know, I love those Western characters where that they're sort of these beaten down men who are very, very, well, somewhat dangerous, but loners. And they kind of rise up and defeat the ultimate evil in the end. And that's kind of what this gunfighter character is. But he's a mentor, and he also was sort of rescued emotionally by the three O'Toole children. And he's had a lot of loss in his life. So in that sense, they both rescue each other. So I find my there's a lot of Caleb in me, and there's a lot of the gunfighter. It just depends on what age I am.
With your actor's eye and with also having traveled the trail to do research for the book, could you see this book being turned into something on film, either in the small or big screen?
Yes, I do. I'm definitely hanging on to those rights. This was originally a story that had been optioned, that I had written for Starz. The Hallmark Channel was doing Westerns at that time. When the movies of the week were put on hold, I got the script back. And the script at that time was, the central character was the gunfighter who adopts the three children. Well, I flipped it, and that's how it ended up, one of the reasons it ended up as a, you know, focusing on the 12-year-old. But it definitely has a possibility of going either to the small screen as a series or, you know, one movie.
Your father, Robert, is no longer with us, but as we discussed earlier, you know, he's a great journalist and writer in his own right. What do you think he'd think of this book, The Last Ride of Caleb O'Toole?
I'm so disappointed he never read it. You know, it just kills me that he was unable to even read a rough draft at that point. He did, however, read the original screenplay and loved it. He was amazed at the story, and he thought it was, you know, he was looking for it. He would ask me every day, every time I would call him, how it's going. And he was very, very supportive. And unfortunately, it never, you know, it never happened that he could read it. I think he'd be proud in a lot of ways. I think anybody who writes and gets a novel published, I think you got to be proud of him somehow. Boy, I tell you, I have a whole new respect for writers. And I think that I think he would, and he'd be proud of the next one too, which is, boy, it's even more fact-finding. It's a Revolutionary War story.
It's a what, I'm sorry?
It's a story that, for the same age group,
right,
takes place 1781 before the Battle of Yorktown.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. I'm sure your father would be very proud indeed. I'm sure the group that's going to be reading this, I understand it's for ages 9 to 12, that will love it as well. The book is called The Last Ride of Caleb O'Toole, written by Eric Pierpoint. And people can check out your website, which is ericpierpoint.net. Eric, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to talk with us.
Great. Thanks so much, Peter.
Eric Pierpoint, author of The Last Ride of Caleb O'Toole. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0213, and you'll find links to Eric's site, plus also links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Batteries not included, some assembly required.
And still to come on the program, we'll have the latest from Ripley's Believe It or Not. Plus, we'll look into that old argument of which one's better, Mac or PC. Plus, we do indeed have an idiot of the day and lots more Stuff File news, including right here, right now, on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Jason Laffman, age 34, of Deltona, Florida, told deputies from the Volusia County Sheriff's Office that he went into code red and lost his temper. Laffman and his mother's boyfriend, Michael Earhart, age 52, had a heated verbal argument and agreed to take it outside to physically fight. Laffman threatened Earhart with a statue, and then things cooled down, and Earhart went into his bedroom to watch TV with Laffman's mother. But Laffman wasn't as cooled off as Earhart thought. The younger man chopped through the bedroom door with a samurai sword, according to deputies. He then grabbed a couple of kitchen knives and threw them at Earhart, according to police, before the older man escaped through a sliding glass door to the outside. Laffman has been charged with aggravated assault with a deadly weapon. And what was the argument all about, you ask? Well, Earhart had accused Laffman of taking a can of shrimp. No, not a small thing after all. Maybe it was jumbo shrimp, I don't know. You know, the guy's last name is actually Laffman, L-A-U-G-H-M-A-N, Laffman. A guy named Laffman with a short fuse, now there's irony for you. Anyway, James Andrews, age 43, tried to use the ATM at his bank in St. Petersburg, Florida. And when the ATM said he had no money in his account, he went inside to find out why. After the teller said he had a negative balance, Andrews allegedly passed a note to the teller demanding $1,000. The teller handed over an undisclosed amount of money and Andrews left. When police found the getaway car, they discovered it was owned by a friend who claimed he gave Andrews a ride to the bank, but didn't know that he had just robbed it. Police were quickly able to track Andrews down and arrest him on charges of strong-arm robbery and possession of crack cocaine and drug paraphernalia. Andrews allegedly told police he needed the money to pay off a drug debt. Well, you know, that last sentence kind of explains everything that comes before it. That one sentence basically says volumes. So let's just move on. Our next millionaire, our next millionaire, announced the Horseshoe Casino in Cincinnati, Ohio, is Kevin Lewis. Okay, Kevin Lewis, age 52, hugged his fiancée and went forward to claim his prize. "When I heard my name, I said, 'God finally gave me a big win,' he said. A lot of screaming and happiness, being at the right place at the right time. Meanwhile, the fiancée of Kevin Lewis, age 50, called him at home. 'I didn't believe it at first,' the second Lewis said. 'I was calm. I calmed my fiancée down. As it turned out, there were two different fiancées and two different Kevin Lewises, both from Cincinnati, both regulars at the casino, and both entered in the giveaway. As soon as they realized their error, the casino made another announcement. Consistent with our commitment to do the right thing for our guests, Horseshoe awarded a $1 million prize to each of the men,' said General Manager Kevin Klein." No. The other Kevin Klein. Yeah. Okay, when dealing with a casino, the irony here is simply saying, what are the odds, as far as this story is concerned? But, you know, seriously, kudos to the casino for doing the right thing. And good karma and subsequent media attention will pay off in the end, I'm sure. And time for one more story before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Anal secretions from beavers can be used in baked goods to create a taste that resembles vanilla, the Swedish National Food Agency said. The agency confirmed the use of the anal passages after rumors about the beaver's secretions circulated on the internet. Natural aromas can be extracts from plants, fungi, and in some cases animals, said Ala Beckman-Sund, an agency representative, as was reported in local newspapers in Stockholm, Sweden. But, she said, the beaver will likely not become a common source of vanilla as the supply is limited because the beaver is not bred. Beavers were wiped out in Sweden in the 19th century, but the population has since grown to 100,000 after the animal was imported. Well, hey, folks, you know, come to Canada. There's plenty of them here. But I do have to ask this one question. Who first made this discovery? I mean, at what point does someone say, hey, you know the stuff coming out of that back end of that animal over there? Let's eat it. Yeah. Alcohol has to be involved in that thought process. That's all I'm thinking. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, shall we? The folks at Ripley's Believe It or Not just keep cranking out great books. Their latest one, just out, is called Dare to Look. And on the line to share what you'll find between the covers of this new tome is Edward Meyer, who is the VP of Exhibits and Archives from Ripley's Believe It or Not. Hi, Edward.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Nice to have you back on the program to talk about yet another Ripley's book. As I said, you guys just keep cranking them out. And I know I ask you this all the time, but do you ever worry about, you know, do we got the stuff for this one?
Well, no, we never worry about that, quite honestly. But, you know, we do books on a fairly frequent schedule, but this is our premium line once a year, our annual, and it's version number 10, called Dare to Look, 250 pages, all color, what most people would refer to as a coffee table book. You don't pick it up and read it from cover to cover, but you pick it up and read a few pages, and no matter where you flip to, you're going to find something that's going to amaze you and probably, hopefully, make you go wow and turn around and tell someone else about it.
We should always mention, for those who have not seen the Ripley's Believe It or Not books, not only are they chock full of information, but as you said, it's full color. They are some of the most beautiful books you'll ever see.
Well, thank you. We put a lot of time in it. The picture researcher actually works out of our office in London, England, and I think James Proud does a spectacular job. I don't think we'll ever run out of Believe It or Not stories, but I often wonder how we keep coming up with such great pictures, because there's about 500 per book, and in general, I think most people, you know, that's what they remember, is the visual image as opposed to, you know, the caption underneath or the sidebar stories that don't have pictures. You know?
And I remember the last time you were on the program, and I believe it's the same with this particular one, too, there is also an app that can enhance what you're looking at within the pages.
Well, absolutely, and I'm glad you mentioned it because we're quite proud of this. We pioneered it last year. It's called OddScan, and anywhere you see a bright green and red logo in the book 18 times that says OddScan, you go to the Apple Store, you can download a free Ripley app, then take pictures of that logo in the book and find hidden content. In most cases, it's video. You know, we'll have one or two pictures per a story in the book, but here's a chance to see more pictures, maybe an interview, always a video. So it's kind of cool. We've added it to our museums as well this year, and it's worked real well for us. You know, it's a chance to, you know, literally take home value that you can go home, look at it at your own leisure, and then maybe hopefully send it along to somebody else through social media.
Excellent. Now let's talk about some of the things that are in the new book, which again is called Dare to Look. I understand there's a guy who has broken the record for pinning clothes pegs to his face. First of all, I don't know why one would do that, even like when do you start doing this? But I believe his name is Ken Mercado or Mercado?
Kevin Mercado. An interesting comment there because, you know, but why is one of the reasons, you know, one of the ways we judge whether something should be in Ripley's. I spent more than a day with Kevin because we actually filmed this process here in Orlando for the OddScan app. So you can actually see video of him doing it, find out how he layers them on there, what his face looks like after he's done it. A little bit of an interview. This one's an interesting one because it's through a translator. He only speaks Spanish. But, you know, learn a little bit about how and why he does it. And after spending about 40 hours with him, I'm still asking the same question, but why? Because I don't understand why someone would do this. I can't imagine waking up one day and saying, hey, I'm going to try and put 161 clothes pegs on my face. And I always sort of relate this kind of feat to sword swallowing. You know, apparently it's not all that difficult to do, but whatever possesses you to try it the first time.
Well, I'm sure he's no relation, but it's funny you should mention that. One of the great sword swallowers is a guy named Dan Meyer, and I've had a chance to talk to him a couple of times, and he's made a career out of that.
Well, Dan Meyer, I've spent a little bit of time with him over the years, hosted a show here with him in Orlando that was quite successful, and his most famous stunt is swallowing a sword underwater, which he actually did at our aquarium in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. But Dan is the president of the International Sword Swallowing Association. There is nobody that knows more about sword swallowing than him. I dare to say there's one or two that are as good as him, but he's really studied the whole history of it, the philosophy. He's a pretty good interview.
Yeah. Getting back to Kevin, you mentioned you don't understand, and I don't, how someone would want to sit down and figure out how many clothespins they can stick to their face. The only thing I can think of, two things would have to come together, alcohol and peer pressure.
Well, I think most people have a byline, you know, and there was beer involved, and, you know, I surmise that that might have something to do with it originally, too. It's, you know, there are other people doing this. This is, Kevin's not the only one. And so once there's one, you know, one person who's done the foolhardy, it doesn't seem to take too much for people to go, well, I can do better than that. And, you know, it keeps both us and the Guinness people in business, that there's always people out there willing to do the extreme stunts that human nature is so curious about and doesn't seem to have any sign of ever not being interested in.
You mentioned the Guinness people. Are they considered to you competition or what?
Well, certainly to me personally. They are actually a sister company. We are both owned by Jim Pattison Industries out of Vancouver, Canada. You know, we're a Canadian-owned company. We run quite independent of them, but our lives overlap once in a while. And typically, you know, we get along just fine. But there's a vast difference. You know, they are interested only in the superlative. You know, it has to be the biggest, the largest, the greatest, whereas Ripley's is really interested in a wider spectrum. You know, we're interested in geography and history and science, the how-to, the why. And, you know, a guy that builds a 35-foot string ball is still as interesting to me as the guy that builds the 36-foot one. So, you know, we're not limited to just one of everything.
Now, I understand there's another thing in the book, this particular book, which is Dare to Look, and that is the biggest collection of ventriloquist dummies?
Well, this is the last three or four books we've done. We've done a multi-page, I think this one's eight pages, a multi-page fold-out that sort of literally is in the center of the book. And this one is a little bit different. I don't claim to be any expert here, but there is a museum on ventriloquists and their dummies. And so we went there, and we talked to some experts, and we filmed some footage of ventriloquist dummies through the ages. And I think most people have had some sort of experience that's etched in their mind of a ventriloquist act. And it goes back at least 100 years, and I guess Charlie McCarthy and Edgar Bergen from the 1930s are probably still the most famous. But I found it very interesting to see that there's a whole history, and each ventriloquist typically has their own characters. You know, they're all sort of stylized with big bulging eyes, but other than that, there's all kinds of things that make them, you know, very independent little creatures of their own. And anybody that's got any interest in this, I think they should take a trip to that museum. It's pretty cool.
And depending how far back you go, these ventriloquist dummies can be extremely valuable because most of them were rather expensive to make for the day anyway.
And for the most part, they're one-ofs. You know, they were hand-done, very specific modifications for the person that's going to operate them. And, you know, they're known by their costumes. So, you know, things like Champagne Charlie's derby hat and other guys' mustache and Rosita's big red bow on her hair, you know, these are the features that immortalize them.
Hmm. One of the other things I understand in the new book, which is called Dare to Look, is you have an artist who makes paintings made with remote control cars.
Well, this is another one of our odd scan features. You can see video of him doing it, as well as a few more pictures than what's in the book. I didn't personally witness this. We did this in our London museum. We ended up displaying the car that he painted that day for us, which is kind of unique. But he literally puts a bunch of paint on the tires of remote control cars and on the paper itself, and then remote controls the cars to create paintings. And these are not abstracts. These are actual paintings of other cars. And for the most part, the cars are zooming around on this piece of paper, and you sort of don't think it's going to be anything, just a bunch of colors. And it really, you know, it's not to the last few seconds that you go, oh, my God, it's, you know, it's an Austin Mini or a Jaguar or a Rolls-Royce. Quite interesting to watch him. The final product is still what I would call a little avant-garde, but the video process that you can follow on our odd scan feature is you know, very entertaining and very educational.
And I'm sure while people are looking at it, what's going through their mind is that line, believe it or not.
Absolutely. And, you know, we are famous for all kinds of different art. Typically, it's the medium that is strange, people making things out of toast or out of toothpicks. But every now and then we find a guy like Ian Cook that, you know, the process as opposed to the medium is what makes him unique.
They're always great books. The latest one is called Ripley's Believe It or Not, Dare to Look. Edward, I thank you very, very much for being on the program with us once again.
Hey, my privilege. Thanks for having us, and hopefully it won't take a year to have us back.
Oh, I'm sure you'll be back way sooner than that. Edward Meyer from Ripley's Believe It or Not. The book is Dare to Look, and you can go to my website at thestufffile.com. Go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0213, and you'll find links to Ripley's website. You'll also find links to Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, where you can order the book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Fantasy football leagues have become very popular, but 4 years ago, a dispute between a fantasy league and the NFL Players Union threatened to end these leagues. The dispute went to court, where a federal judge ruled that the public use of these players' names and statistics is protected by the First Amendment. Today, there are more fantasy leagues than we can count, but other kinds of disputes have now become a reality. When star players are injured, it can ruin a fantasy team. And arguments between fantasy owners are becoming common. Let's be fair. Some would say that the thought of keeping lawsuits out of any corner of American life, even fantasy football, is a fantasy itself. But believe it or not, an actual insurance market has sprung up to protect fantasy owners when players are injured. And a law professor has even offered to moderate disputes for only $15. Maybe ending the lawsuit problem in America doesn't have to be fantasy after all. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
Coming to you from the outskirts of sanity, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come in the program, we'll talk about Mac versus PC, and we do indeed have an idiot of the day, but I've got one more Stuff File news story to get to before we get to that point in the program. On a program that you know, folks, is also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, it sat on Best Buy shelves, honestly labeled a useless plastic box. A sign said, another gadget you don't really need, will not work once you get it home, new model out in 4 weeks, battery life is too short to be of use. But one part of the labeling was false. The electronics chain wasn't actually selling the useless plastic box for $99.99 or any other price. UPBs had been placed at various Los Angeles area Best Buy locations by Plastic Jesus, a 48-year-old prank artist, and stayed on the shelves for up to 5 days. I, like many people out there, am a gadget freak, he explained. I rush out and get the new iPhone when it comes out, but so often you are left disappointed. Plastic Jesus said Best Buy employees have actually emailed him about buying UPBs. Wow, that's what I keep saying. Electronic sheep. They'll want to buy anything if they think it's new. And by the way, for the record, I don't have a smartphone. In fact, my cell phone is so old, it's rotary. Anyway, let's get to our next guest. Speaking of electronics and technology, shall we? Everybody has witnessed the ongoing debate between Mac versus PC, and there are computer evangelists on both sides who see their platform as being the best. But is there really a difference? On the line with us right now is technology expert Mike Salvaggio, who is co-founder of CEO Brand, to talk about the two platforms. And he joins us from New Jersey. Hi, Mike.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on the program with us. So we've heard this ongoing battle, well, since the beginning, basically. Has the battle changed? Has it become a level playing field? Or is it the same two camps as always?
Well, I think it's more of the two camps as always, but every day, Macs seem to cut more into the market share that was once dominated by Windows PCs, just because of the availability of these machines just to make things work. So, you know, the majority of people that are using computers are just novices, right? They just want to browse the internet, they want to check their email, they want to play around on social media, and Macs make it very easy to do these basic functions, as to where Windows sometimes gets confused in terms of, I need to be a hardcore coder or a programmer to really have all these different capabilities, where the majority of people just want to check their email and browse the web.
So basically, it's the same old divide. It used to be at one point that people would go to Mac because it was more user-friendly, or they were in the graphical world, and people went to PCs because there were clones, and thus they were cheaper.
That's correct. But Macs now have a different type of aura about them. So they are more of a brand. So, I mean, they're considered like the Gucci of computers. And the style that goes into a Mac is much more elegant than you would see from your typical Windows PC. So that has a big part to do with it as well.
Okay, so once we get past the status of whichever one you prefer or whatever you've gone with in the past, when you get right down to the nuts and bolts, is there someone who should be on a Mac more than a PC or vice versa, like the graphical argument I made just a moment ago?
I think so. Now, when you're talking about Windows PCs, if you're someone that is inside of IT infrastructure, since the majority of companies are built off of Windows PC infrastructure, then you really have no choice but to use a Windows-dominated PC. But when you're in the business of, let's say, design, there are better software programs that are available. The interface with Mac is better, and it's just known to be able to service this type of vertical. It's been dominant inside the graphical industry. But, I mean, there's a lot of things to look at. I mean, just outside of the design, what niche it serves, it's also safer against malware because the malware writers and the virus writers are writing these viruses more for the dominant market share of computers. So there's more viruses that are out there. That doesn't mean that there are no viruses available for Mac. There are, but the hackers and the virus writers are going against, well, they're going for who owns more of these computers. So they're just more dominant and prevalent with that PCs.
But as you say, as Macs become more of a force in the market against PC, wouldn't that virus equation change?
It does, and it's starting to change now. But I think the consensus out there is, well, I'm going to just get a Mac because I don't have to worry about viruses. That's not true at all. It just becomes a numbers game at this point. But yes, as this shifts more towards Mac grabbing market share, you're seeing it becoming an increasingly problem for Mac owners who thought they were once safe from viruses and malware.
Now, what about the programs? I've always maintain that one of the ways the company keeps you is that, you know, you go with a PC and you have your software, and even if you upgrade your PC, you still have your software. But with some of the newer incarnations of Windows, for instance, sometimes you've had to go and buy a whole new software. Isn't that the opportunity that the other company has to jump in? Because that was always the fear. I'm not going to switch platforms. I have to change everything.
That's correct. I mean, a switching cost is always the case. I mean, you're going to have to buy software for one machine, and then if you switch to another one, well, then there's a certain amount of importing you need to do, and you're right. Maybe you just need to go out and buy a version of the software that's suitable for that operating system. So that could be a big cost, especially if you're leveraged pretty heavily in software, which a lot of people are. I mean, they're invested into different types of maybe financial programs and whatever they're using to manage their day-to-day. But the availability of cloud applications have really changed that whole market. So for now, I mean, you could just open up a program on Dropbox that could be accessible from a Mac or from a PC and load all of your storage onto the cloud. Same thing goes with managing your calendar with Google. And a lot of these apps are free. So, you know, outside of being able to have that switching cost issue where you have maybe local software installed on your drive, you're seeing that become less of a problem right now with these cloud-based applications.
Are you, I should have asked off the top, but are you a PC or a Mac user?
I'm a Mac user.
And why is that?
But that's not fair. Everyone in our office that are writing code, everyone is using a PC. So there's certain uses for Mac and for PC. I don't get into hardcore code writing. We have teams that do that. But basically, I'm using it for web browsing, financial applications, Microsoft Excel. I mean, all of that can be easily done on the Mac, but it could be from the PC. And you know, plus, I like the way it looks.
Well, I was just about to ask, why are you a PC user? And was it a difficult choice whenever you had to make that choice?
Yeah, well, the fear of me switching to Mac was very big. And the people that I talked to, at least the majority of them that have made the switch, that they should have done it years ago, it wasn't as difficult as I thought it would be. And for me, I had everything that was based off of a PC. I learned computers on PC and been on PC for the last 20 years. So to make the switch, it was a gradual switch. But we always kept the Mac in our house, regardless of whether or not I was on PCs. The family always used the Mac, so I was somewhat familiar with the interface. But it wasn't until I made the full switch, only because I got tired of the endless updates. Windows at that time, with Windows ME, Windows Vista. They released a bunch of different buggy operating systems that they always told you you were forced to upgrade into, when half the time you could have stayed on your older platforms like Windows XP that were running much more of a stable environment. So I just got tired of the computer constantly crashing, and I heard a lot of people were switching, and you know, I just made the switch, and I'm happy I did.
PC is still the dominant platform, but do you see a day where it won't be?
I won't be surprised. What's happening right now in the marketplace is you're just seeing the internet being accessed through tablets and through mobile devices. So I think at some point, the gradual disappearance of the desktop computer is going to happen. But whether or not Mac will be able to grab that space, I think it remains yet to be seen. Microsoft is trying all different types of things to get into the lucrative mobile market that they seem to have missed. So I would not be surprised if Apple, who every time you turn around they do something, even better than their last move, would be able to grab a significant slice of this.
I mentioned in the introduction that you're the co-founder of SEO Brand. Tell us a little bit about what SEO Brand does.
Sure. We're a full-service web development and search engine optimization company. So we could build any type of mobile application, desktop application, web design, and then more importantly, get that website listed on the search engines for top ranking when you do a search on Google, Bing, or Yahoo. That tends to drive sales, tends to drive leads to the business, and overall brand exposure. We have 4 offices scattered pretty much throughout the globe, and we've been growing at a double-digit rate for the last 5 years. So there's pretty exciting things happening over here. We're at the forefront of all different types of search and social technology, and pretty much can lay out a plan for any business looking to establish their brand online.
You mentioned a couple of things about the PC world. One was that at the time that you made the switch yourself from PC to Mac, a lot of their applications were kind of buggy when they were bringing out new applications. And also you mentioned the fact that they kind of missed the boat when it came to mobile applications. Do you think those are their two biggest mistakes? And if not, what is their, or what has been their biggest mistake?
Microsoft built a gigantic company off of software running on local machines. And that's really where they focused in on. They also built a substantial business by powering IT infrastructure. So, I mean, that's really where the core of their business is. So I don't know if either one of those would be considered mistakes, because that's just what it is. But I think that they missed a big shift. They didn't see how big the internet would be. And there's always this talk in our circle about how Microsoft pretty much, they missed the internet in a lot of ways that they did. I mean, they let Google come in and pretty much take over the search game without dipping into search. I mean, recently they've released Bing, and Bing continues to cut into Google's market share, and it's a very, very good search engine that you certainly consider using if you're an avid Google user, like I'm assuming you are, like everyone else is. But they also missed out on the mobile market. That was a gigantic mistake for Microsoft, because you pretty much allowed an unknown system, which was Android, purchased by Google and Apple, just to pretty much cut the entire market up pretty much right in front of their face. So it's kind of unbelievable that a company like Microsoft wouldn't realize how big the internet would be and wouldn't make a substantial early position to get a good device. Now, on that sense, they've bought Nokia, they've made some pretty interesting acquisitions with Skype, and it looks like that they're clawing their way back into the picture. So you can never count out a company like Microsoft.
And even though we've discussed this and talked about the battle between Mac versus PC, are there still evangelists on both sides who swear that theirs is the best and nothing else comes close?
Oh, there's no question about it. I mean, you put a bunch of tech guys into a room and the passions are going to start flying. I mean, you know, one person is going to sit there and staunchly defend Apple and vice versa for Microsoft. And we have quite a bit of those arguments inside the office. There's pros and cons to both. You cannot have one without the other, I believe, and it represents a good challenging ecosystem in the IT world.
Mike, I thank you very much for talking to us on the program.
Thank you very much for having me. Take care.
Mike Salvaggio, co-founder of SEO Brand. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com. Go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0213, and you'll find links to their site. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
Richard Bordeaux was charged in January with burglarizing Kenny's Seafood, where he had previously worked in Slidell, Louisiana, when he became the most recent perp to fail to outflank surveillance cameras. He had thought to wear a bucket over his head as he moved through the store, except he had waited until well inside within camera range before actually putting it on. Okay, first off, how does one see with a bucket over their head? But regardless of that, how can a person not know the range of the surveillance cameras of the place they want to rob, which just happens to be the place where they used to work? Well, there's one reason, and one reason only. They're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0213. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0213. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. While it may be an enjoyable, pleasant experience, some side effects may occur. Listening to Peter may cause bloating, drowsiness, Tourette's, web feet, or an oily discharge.